This episode of AVXL was recorded on April 19th, 2018. We're going to talk about Robert's new headphones, ATSC 3.0, the future of broadcast TV. That's ATSC 3.0, OLED burn-in, Atmos speakers, tiny surround sound speakers, and so much more.
Testing 1, 2, 3. All right. I'm not blowing anything out.
Ignorant weasels chewing on your soul. Ignorant weasels. Do you have speed?
Yeah.
Welcome to AVXL, your guide to the best in home theater and audio gear, no matter what your budget is. I'm Patrick Norton.
Hey, I am Robert Herron.
And you are excited.
I am.
You have a new toy.
I'm always excited, especially this week, I have to say. Couple new toys, per your advice. I went ahead and picked up the Sony, the MDR7506, the quote-unquote professional large diaphragm headphones, along with the amazing little box called the Shit Full of Two. And the Full of Two arrives today, but the 7506s are already in hand and have received some use using my older amplifier that's connected to my workstation. I'm appreciating the differences of a quote-unquote set of professional headphones versus something that's probably more optimized for gaming that I was currently using or was using before that. I'm really enjoying the A-being of these headphones with the variety of content out there, be it gaming, be it music. I have most of my content archived as FLAC files as far as my music goes. Like you suggested, spend a good 6 months with those. Go through everything you have and take it in before you go above and beyond to buy more expensive gear.
So they're tuned a little bit, right? We were talking about sort of the difference between the bass and the treble and how they compare to each other. The conversation I got into at CanJam down in LA is one of the things that Dr. Sean Olive says is it can be difficult, unless you're a particularly well-trained listener, to know the difference between increased bass and decreased treble or increased treble and decreased bass. Like, it's actually a fairly subtle thing.
That was one of the first things I noticed compared to my quote-unquote gaming headphones that I was using before. Apparently, they are warmer. Bass in general seemed to be more represented than the treble side of it. Or perhaps treble was turned down a little bit. That's a good question, actually. I would have to be able to measure that somehow, which I have no means of. But
that's a whole nother conversation.
I've gotten used to the sound, though, of my previous headphones. So in a sense, I had an appreciation for that quote-unquote warmer sound. I feel that the Sonys are not lacking in bass. It's just that the representation of, say, the high-end frequencies is better on the Sonys. So perhaps I'm just simply hearing it more clearly than before. Anyway, for the next few weeks, I will definitely be doing a lot of A-B comparisons.
One of the things I started playing around with recently is there was this amazing Philips Golden Ears training program that has since been removed from the website.
Oh.
Yeah, it's a shame because it was amazing. They walked you through identifying different elements of audio and what they were, and like distortion or the highs and lows, and it would basically work your ears out and your brain out to educate you and to teach you how to make you like what they call a trained listener. And the training isn't so much about what you hear, but more actually being able to identify and accurately describe what you're hearing. But Harman actually has what they call their how-to listen training software, which is pretty old school. I don't think it's changed since like 2011 or 2012. But
if you had like known samples that
you can download it and run it.
Yeah, but if you had something where it's like, okay, listen to this, and they know what has been done to that audio, so they can say, this is how it will sound, say, if the bass frequencies are taken down by 10% or up by 10%, or if it's being compressed in a certain way, or just being able to tell you exactly what it is you're listening to and then to provide those audible examples. I think that sounds like a great way to educate yourself and to get your ears trained a little bit better.
Yeah, I mean, I'll dig out the link for the How to Listen, the Harman How to Listener software. I'll also say, it can be useful to go to audiocheck.net and go to their sound tests. For example, they've got a bass sweep that starts impossibly low and works its way up. And it can be amazing to hear what's supposed to be like, we talk about this a lot. There's specs that are like, it's 20 hertz to 20 hertz, but they don't tell you it's negative dB at 20 hertz, right? But then when you play this sweep, which goes from the lowest to the highest tones, you're like, this very nice voice from audiocheck.net goes, 20 hertz, and then it plays a tone, 30 hertz.
Oh, nice.
40 hertz. And what you notice is you'll be like, wait, what was that 20? And then meh, and then meh, and then meh, and then you can get a feel for like, hey, these may not be going as low as I think they are because I read the thing. But
in my dabbling of speaker testing, I will use a calibrated mic and run those same sweeps through there. And it becomes very it's nice when you can simply graph that stuff out and say, yeah, comparing speaker A to speaker B, the cutoffs are definitely different. And it's visually a way to look at that. But yeah, a good set of test tones that are well defined, like you just described, would be another way to do it without gear per se. Just a way for you to do a quick check. Yeah, it may claim it can produce a sound at 20 hertz, but yeah, the fall off is such that you're not really getting much out of that.
Yeah, and it's, you know, well, that's we'll go into that conversation another day.
No, but it's
the claims and the realities. And the other thing to remember is that everybody's ears are different. That's something that Dan Clark from Mr. Speakers was saying is, you know, different sizes and shapes and how they extend from your ear, your pinnae, the part of your ear that hangs off the side of your skull, mine are very, very large. They stick out a lot, and that's going to create a different I want to say reference tone, but that's not the right phrase. I'm grossly not quoting the right thing, but you know
the response.
Yeah, the
can affect perception, but I also think
plus
too, it's
whatever
just like,
damage you've done to your ears, the shape of your ears, the shape of your ear. A friend of mine had a story where everybody thought these headphones were horribly treble heavy, and then this one friend put them on. It's like these sound amazing. Well, it turned out he basically had corkscrews. He ended up at an audiologist and found out he had, you know, the human equivalent of corkscrews for ear canals. Oof. And the corkscrews essentially dampened so much of the treble that he never actually heard much treble from a normal set of headphones.
Understood.
Yeah, I can't wait to hear what you think of the shit full of two. It's a nice piece of hardware.
I can't wait. As soon as we're done here, I'm heading over to my local UPS store and pick those suckers up. They should be delivered any moment now.
Oh, my goodness.
That'll be a fun AB because I'm probably using something really cheap in terms of what came with my gaming headphones as a USB amplifier. I'm really curious to see what the sound quality difference is with the headphones using a better amp or a known quantity, so to speak. And I'm looking forward to that. I also got some new UHD Blu-rays too that I'm looking forward to checking out, and I'll get into that later. But
copy that. Oh my goodness. I got a Kavo to review, much to my surprise, Leo up in Petaluma Twit had one, and it was just like, so I ended up being like, yeah, I'll test it, or maybe you'll test it. But we talked about this when it was first announced, right? This idea of the single interface, that's the one. This interface.
Unifying interface.
Yeah, unify all your devices, your apps, and content into a single experience. So, you know, there's a voice-enabled remote, or you can use Alexa, and it keeps up to 8 HDMI devices connected. It's supposed to, you know, make super seamless high-speed HDMI switching. Doesn't matter if it's cable or satellite, you know, Apple TV, Roku boxes, gaming consoles, you know, DVD, Blu-ray players. You're supposed to be able to search across all your content, which is the holy grail for at least one of our listeners.
Very cool.
4K is available. I don't think it's HDR yet. It's actually a 4K version up on the website, so I was wrong about that. And then I have discreet inquiries out regarding HDR support.
Gotcha. Still, Austin, though, I appreciate things that can do fast switching. I was recently working on a JVC projector, and you want to talk about the slowest transitions between you're switching, say, from 1080p to a 4K source. Could be 10 seconds of nothing before you see something. And that feels like forever in a home theater environment. And having a device that fast HDMI switching is just something I've come to appreciate on better AVRs. And
I inherited a like 5 years newer Onkyo AVR from a friend of ours. And it was also a significantly nicer AVR than I would normally pay for out of pocket because children in Northern California.
Understood.
But the priorities, feeding the children.
But
it was the
survival.
Thing that I, the two things I love the most, you know, upgrading from my like, you know, $400 entry level 5.1 AVR was not the 7.1 support, was not the additional HDMI ports. You know, there is no particular difference in audio quality, but how much faster it switches between HDMI ports and being able to label the HDMI ports. The difference in there was this like 3 or 4 year period where AVR manufacturers went from, you know, this would look okay if you're used to DOS on an NTSC monitor. So we'll just put it on your 1080p screen. And now there's actual fonts you can read on a 1080p or 4K screen and actual visual elements.
That's always
interfaces.
The annoying, where you have a modern product that's supposedly a 4K compatible device, yet it's using graphics that are, you know,
straight out of 640 by 480. Yeah.
Standard def at best. There's a company called Simplay Labs that does HDMI verification and testing, and I've always appreciated the companies that run their products through them. They'll verify switching speeds and compatibility with devices. Effectively, if you ever see that stamp somewhere in the manual for the device you just bought, that's a good sign, I've come to believe. It's just every time I come across a product where you usually have to dig around to look, they're not the most... They're not the most promoted company. They're more the back end folks taking care of verification and testing. But when that stamp's on there, it's something where I'm like, okay, I'm willing to bet this isn't going to lag like 15 seconds between switching ports or compatibility with the variety of devices I'm throwing at it. It just seems like I have fewer issues. Although it costs money for these companies to stick that stamp on their particular product. So
many stamps. Got an email from Austin who writes in, I've got the LG OLED 55B7A. I have Netflix 4K streaming on my Roku. I've noticed that the darker scene quality is way better. To me, HDR is worth it. I just got done watching the new series Lost in Space in 4K HDR, and wow. When I look at the stream quality, though, mine is showing a max of 15.26 megabits per second, 2160. Is that the max that you guys have seen? I also wanted to say thanks for the details you share about audio and video calibration. So many options, and your info helps a lot. Thanks, Austin. Well, thank you, Austin. We are here to share the love and the knowledge and the ability and to make things look better. So,
indubitably.
To hear that it's useful is heartwarming.
That's the exact same speed I get with my mega connection here to my 4K TV with 4K Netflix streaming. I have never seen it go above that.
You know, we were talking about this because we had a viewer question on Tech Thing about this. And Netflix, when it launched 4K... They wanted 15 megabits when they were kind of pre-launch, and then it jumped to 25 megabits per second. So Netflix and Apple both want your ISP to deliver a steady 25 megabits per second for 4K content.
And I think we've mentioned it before. That's likely due to the fact that you might not be the only one in your household, and they know they're going to push 15 megabit at the max, yet they're going to tell you 25 megabit just to ensure that when somebody else is on the computer, you're not getting hit with stuttering and delays and other video-related streaming issues that you may then blame on the service rather than your internet connection. So,
and they hate it when you do that.
The service calls are the bane of these companies.
You know, for perspective, right, Netflix and Apple are both asking for 25 megabits per second. Amazon is calling for 15 megabits for 4K. Vudu says their minimum requirement is 11 megabits per second, but I think they'll stream at a higher resolution than that if they can. For comparison, for Netflix, for 1080 HD video, all they're looking for is 5 megabits per second. Hmm. So maybe, you know, Netflix, because Netflix is a data company, a data mining company. So they probably know, like, the typical 4K household might be running a 4K and two 1080p streams at certain times of the day. And I think that's where the 25 megabit per second number came from. But
they've also done a lot of work in the last few years in terms of going through all of their video, analyzing, in terms of a variable bitrate encoding system, what they need to get a certain level of quality with the least amount of bits possible to save them money, to save you hassle and time in terms of getting that stream up to the max quality it can. And they keep working on that constantly. And in the case of something like a B7A OLED, that's an awfully nice thing to watch Netflix content with. When my recent trip to the Netflix headquarters in Los Angeles, I found them using LG panels as their studio monitors in terms of looking at content in both standard and high dynamic range. That's what they're looking at when they're evaluating the content they're creating themselves. So I guarantee you that's going to be one of the very best TVs to enjoy your Netflix streaming on. And even on the TVs I look at, be it the LCD or OLED, I find the HDR experience, especially with streaming content, or disc, of course, but the color improvements, the contrast, I mean, obviously, OLED's going to make everything look really contrasty, is just a fantastic format. And I'm just simply glad we have these available for the folks that maybe don't want to deal with discs anymore, but still want a good HDR experience.
Yeah.
Not great. Well, it looks pretty good, but nothing's going to beat a UHD Blu-ray with the megabits and...
Our goal is for it to not suck.
Yes. The bit rates, you know, hey,
15 megabit. And look, and if you're somewhere where you can't get 15 megabit and yet you have a higher end home theater that's all 4K mm-hmm. ready, you definitely want to be considering some discs then. It would suck to have, say, a great 4K TV, surround sound setup and everything like that, but you're just simply limited in terms of your ISP selections and you're unable to get a solid, say, 20 megabit into your room. That's where then, say hello to the ultra high def Blu-ray disc. And granted, it's a little expensive, but still, I'm buying those discs just simply because we always brag about that. That's what you compare everything else to. And it's going to remain that way for a while. Mm-hmm. So I don't see anything else better coming along in the short term.
Copy that. It was funny. Last week on Tech Thing, we talked about over-the-air TV antennas. A friend of mine had asked about that. And that led to a bunch of follow-up questions from people about ATSC. Or as I like to call it, the Advanced Television Systems Committee 3.0 standard or broadcast TV over IP. Because I asked you, I'm like, did you see anything at CES?
I've seen demos at previous shows as a test setup. Mm-hmm. At CES this year, or back in January, the only demo I recall on the show floor was in the Hisense booth. They had their own like homebrew where it's like, hey, we've got a broadcast antenna, a box with content, and then we have a couple devices you can actually watch it on just within our booth. So it was a totally canned demo, but it was actually using broadcast signals with appropriate receivers. It included mobile devices, which is, I think, going to be one of the neat things about this new broadcast standard going forward. In addition to delivering 4K video over the air, high frame rate perhaps, wide color gamut, HDR, of course, but that compatibility looking forward where you'll be able to have mobile devices that are supporting this content. You could see not only for mobile phones, but for maybe even in-car entertainment systems adopting the receivers that'll be taking advantage of this kind of content. It's going to be the future. Don't be in a hurry for ATSC3. It's a work in progress.
Yeah.
They are still literally in the testing phases right now.
So I guess Phoenix is going to be the big testing ground for ATSC 3.0 rollouts. But you're saying this was not the first ATSC 3.0
Google WRAL TV in, I think it's Raleigh, North Carolina. They have been the test center for the previous ATSC standard mm-hmm. and the current one. And they are broadcasting their live content in a 1080p format using the new system, as well as a looped stream of 4K HDR content as well. Other countries, like in particular South Korea,
right.
They deployed it, I think, over a year ago, just gearing up for being able to distribute the recent Olympic Games, the Winter Games, in a 4K HDR format. And some of the other cool aspects of ATSC 3 is that it effectively becomes a packetized TV delivery system. Mm-hmm. So it enables many data layers that you right. can then incorporate other services and features. And if you pair that with, say, a broadband connection to return information back to the broadcaster, that would do things for the broadcasters that they would appreciate in terms of being able to do targeted advertising and things like that. But it also could enable just some interesting services that I haven't even thought about yet, really.
Well, it's also, I mean, so one of the things people don't realize is over the air still the, you know, quote, the most popular method of watching live events, you know, unquote.
I think for over the air TV, that's probably what it's used the most for.
But the, ATSC 3.0 promises better reception, especially in densely packed urban areas.
Thank goodness. Looking forward to that.
You know, cities will get a boost in performance. It's a proper 4K UHD spec with support for HDR and high frame rates. You will no longer have to scan for channels, which is kind of awesome. You could have access to more channels because
I'll believe it when I see it.
Yeah, I mean, I was told by an engineer whose opinion I trust, who's probably listening right now. I think he was saying he's because of H.265 compression, they're getting like 8 streams in the space of a single channel at this point. Dolby AC4, which will support 7.1.4 channel audio, including Atmos or DTS:X. It'll bring over-the-air broadcast to mobile gear like smartphones and tablets, or that you'll be able to like basically run it in your car or RV. You'll need a single in-home gateway to use ATSC 3.0 with your devices in the house. Localized emergency alerts for amber alerts or severe weather warnings.
See, that last point you made, though, about the single device for bringing access into your home, because it's so they've reworked it to be compatible with IP systems.
Right.
So say, a network-enabled tuner within your home would then drive any connected device within that home that's compatible with ATSC 3 as well. How nice is that? That to me is going to be a like not only a money saver, but just a convenience thing. Mm-hmm. If you want to be able to walk from room to room in different TVs and not have to repurchase, say, a compatible converter box or something like that for every individual TV in the home. It's one of those usage scenarios where I'm just like, yeah, thank you. This sounds right. However, there is no set date for when any of this is mandatory.
Well, this is a classic tech rollout.
Yes.
You know, there's a chicken, there's an egg, one of them's got to come first. And, you know, broadcasters have some real compelling benefits to rolling out ATSC 3.0. The ability to sell video on demand, selling seasons for binge watching so you don't buy them on Netflix or on iTunes.
There's good watermarking and content protection schemes built in. So.
You know, the possibility of one thing I read in one article was like over-the-air skinny bundles so they could be competing with, you know, YouTube and DirecTV and everybody else that's selling cable subscriptions.
Is that a PlayStation View? Talk to your local broadcaster.
They'll get instant viewage stats for TV stations. They can create super hyper-targeted local advertising. They can start polling. You know, it's you know, the whole...
It's a nice jump in terms of usability and things that I've always found slow on current built-in ATSC systems, like a channel guide populating and navigating on a TV's built-in tuner setup. Every TV I look at, it's always a disappointment.
Yeah.
One thing I realized, too, is that with the last transition we had from the NTSC system to the ATSC system is that they provided coupons and other means for people who needed a converter box and things like that to be able to, you know, here's a $50 coupon to get you your old TV compatible with the new system. I don't see anything like that coming for ATSC 3. And we're still looking at...
Well, it's early.
It is.
We're not... You were
saying... A couple
of
test broadcasters currently.
Yeah. No televisions exist.
No.
No standalone tuners exist yet. So I'm thinking like it's going to start to trickle out in 2019.
Yeah.
It's going to start flooding in 2020 maybe. Because there's... I mean...
I'll be curious to see if the chipsets are integrated into TVs at CES coming up. That will be in January of next year. That will be interesting. That would be a good flag to see how soon is it really happening. And they're talking literally it could be out toward 2025 before the transition's fully finished. So, and broadcasters...
I think they're going to try to start rolling this out hard in 2020.
Yeah.
For one basic reason. It's a presidential election year.
Oh.
And there's billions of dollars of local advertising money. It's
another Olympic Games too, isn't it?
Probably.
Summer Games?
But it's also, you know, one of the things that comes in with ATSC 3.0 is the, because they're sort of, you know, digitizing and packetizing all this, they can automate the ad buying and insertion process. And again, make it super local and super hyper-targeted. And people don't realize there's still tens of billions of dollars in over-the-air broadcasting advertising revenue. You know, there could be like a $20 billion, you know,
what if what if ATSC 3 requires a broadband connection to your local broadcaster or to that central? That brings to me some privacy issues and other things. There had better be a way to use this technology without having it broadband connected. That will be one of the main questions I'm going to propose to anybody planning this hardware.
There's not too many people to ask at this point because
not
stuff,
really.
So I'm going to be meeting with hopefully be sitting in on a luncheon with some area broadcasters, learning more about this later this month. I will report more news as the stations roll out and hardware actually shows up.
Very cool.
We had a question, and we're not sure if it was Robert who asked it. Me who asked it, one of you beautiful people in the audience who asked it, one of our Patreons who supports us at patreon.com/AVXL and makes the show possible, please join the crew at patreon.com/AVXL, that wanted to know if OLED had burn-in problems.
That's a good question. There is potential there for it. Whether or not it is a problem is a more difficult question to answer. I will point to...
They aren't that old yet.
No. And the technology is updated on a yearly basis in terms of how they're made and manufactured. I will point to the good folks over at ratings.com. That's RTINGS. And they have been doing a long-term burn-in test on 2016 models. And they've recently, in the last, say, few months, revamped it for a set of similar, I want to say they're all B7As, 2017 burn-in test using a more realistic variety of content running on these panels. And they're using six panels in particular, and each one is configured either for a 200 nit output, which is about a roughly a third of the total light output of the TV, as well as a max mode where the TV is just set to be as bright as possible. And there is enough variation going on in terms of what they're seeing. They posted a recent YouTube video going over some of the updates on it, as well as some articles on their website. And just to kind of paraphrase some of it, it is not a good idea to leave high contrasted static imagery on these TVs. That's probably not something you want to do for hours on end on a regular basis. Otherwise, they appear to be pretty robust in terms of watching regular video content. But if you're a person who's watching, say, Bloomberg News with the stock ticker at the bottom constantly, I think eventually you will see some image retention that's permanent on those brightened areas. I would treat these more like plasmas than I would like LCDs for general content. And they also highlighted an issue that required LG engineers to visit their labs. And it turns out that there were some 55-inch OLEDs that were affected during the manufacturing part of 2017 that could have a 25% window that was visible. Ooh. Apparently, LG was using this window as a test setup during the manufacturing process to verify the performance of the TVs. And apparently, that, in certain cases, that window was still visible after you even took it out of the box. It turns out that it wasn't actually the panel itself, but the way the TV's lookup tables were programmed using these test patterns. They didn't have to replace the panels in these TVs, but they did have to come in and actually reprogram them in order to minimize that artifact. And this did not correct obvious cases of permanent image retention in some of these panels, but it did get rid of this one factory weird issue of this 25% window that was being used during the initial setup. And it turns out that if you are seeing this 25% box, you can contact LG, even if your TV's out of warranty at this point, and have them come and reprogram it to eliminate that particular issue. So, are OLEDs susceptible to burn-in? Every display system is susceptible to burn-in. LCDs generally are more robust, but I've seen some LCDs with incredible amounts of burn-in. Just about every user manual you look at, LCD or OLED, is going to mention this as an issue that we will not honor a warranty claim on. It's like, you know, even though it is an LCD, we do not recommend you leave these static images on there for days on end. So,
yeah, I mean, all you have to do is go to Vegas, and you will find, you know, eventually, if you keep looking at televisions, especially as you get into the older and older casinos, you will see spectacular examples of burn-in.
I always go back to the example of, I think it was the Wynn Hotel when it first opened. They installed probably 10,000 of these sharp LCD panels as display systems for Kino and other ads like that. And for the ones that were displaying Kino in like a static grid format with bright white lines and bright white squares, I came back the following year and all of those TVs had permanent burn-in. And I noticed that at some point during that year, they had then instituted motion screens or motion graphics on the screen so that it wasn't completely static anymore. But yeah, don't assume that an LCD is completely immune to burn-in either, but it takes a lot more work compared to, say, an OLED.
Yeah.
And another odd thing, and I will give credit to the ratings folks for really being able to create a six-panel long-term test of burn-in, they were finding that the TVs running at full max brightness were less influenced by burn-in than some of the TVs that were running at, say, the 200 nit level. And it seemed counterintuitive, and I'm fascinated by this, and I look forward to following it along. I can't wait until we take a look at some of the 2018 TVs. I'm hoping everything learned in these last couple of years, the 2016 and 2017 series of LG's panels, has been rolled into the 2018 series in terms of making sure that these are less and less of a concern going forward.
Got a question about Atmos add-on speakers from Mike, who posted on Patreon. And Mike, thank you for being our patron. He says, do you have any recommendations for Dolby Atmos add-on speakers? I've upgraded my AVR to a Denon S930H, and I have a 5.1 setup with in-ceiling surrounds and PSB towers plus center. I was wondering if something like the ELAC A4 would be a good addition on top of my towers to get the Atmos height component. The room is fairly small, about 16 feet deep, and doubles as my spouse's telework office, so I have limited options for additional speaker locations. Any other issues to keep in mind for an Atmos setup? Thanks, love the show. Mike in Arlington, Virginia. And my first thought is that if you've got PSB Towers, which are lovely speakers, you might want to take a look at the Imagine XA, which is their stack on top of your speaker, Dolby Atmos speaker. And that's actually also the first PSB Dolby Atmos enabled speaker. So you could use it in a two-channel or a four-channel arrangement. You know, I would also say, since you already have surrounds in the ceiling,
yeah,
I would consider putting your Atmos speakers in the ceiling. Because while I have heard some very effective Atmos demos involving the stack on top of your speakers, for example, like that Imagine XA, which is, you know, designed by the same crew that designed your towers, if you go to an Atmos demo at Dolby Labs, I assure you, unless they are talking about, you know, stackable speakers,
right,
they are going to have the speakers in the ceiling.
Without a doubt.
So that's something.
Two or four are generally what you want for the Dolby Atmos setups in a home theater environment. And generally, with surround speakers, it would be ideal to have the Dolby Atmos height channels somewhere in front of you a little bit.
Yeah.
And adequately place them that way. And if you can do them in the ceiling, that's definitely what you want to do.
I mean,
and depending on where his surrounds are, maybe they could be simply repurposed as the Atmos speakers. And if you already have, say, two up there,
yeah,
maybe just get some towers then to replace those for the surrounds, or, you know,
remember, home office.
Oh, yeah. Or something smaller, maybe wall-mounted surrounds or something like that. And then simply utilize move the wires to be the Atmos speakers for those surrounds that are already there. But that was just one thought I had.
I mean, they're pretty simple to set up, right? You basically stack the Atmos speakers ideally on top of your existing speakers.
As far as the upfiring designs go.
And they bounce off the ceiling, and the timing on that is handled by your AVR. And the general rule of thumb I've gotten from various people is that, you know, Atmos speakers from, you know, if you want to go with the ELACs, you know, those WA4s are out there. They also have the, along with the Debut 2.0 series, they've got the Debut A4.2, which is, I don't think there's been any huge changes to that speaker, not anything comparable to the difference between the Debut and the Debut 2.0. But if you want to experiment with it, and maybe those are less expensive, that's certainly an option for you. But I would just, I always try to match my surround sound system from the same manufacturer.
Right.
Just because it gives me warm and fuzzies. You know, and I've also heard some staggeringly mismatched systems.
Let's talk about the room I'm in right now with the center channel that is clearly different from the rest of the speakers.
One of these things is not like the other.
But so that's difficult to make that sound right. I was just like,
breathe. Speaking of tiny little speakers mounted up near the ceiling.
Jesus. It's horrible. Don't do that. Don't buy those tiny cube speakers unless you have to.
Do you hear that?
Please stop.
AJ's hearing that. At AJ Smith tweeted, bought a new home. Woo! Any thoughts on if there's anything to replace these small Bose speakers? At AVXL, at Robert Heron, at Patrick Norton. Love the show. Proud of support on at Patreon. Thank you, AJ. And there's this picture of this magnificent living room with this gorgeous leather couch. I suspect this was not to say that AJ's home isn't going to be fabulously and fastidiously decorated, but boy, this reeks of having been staged by a real estate agent. But there are little tiny surround sound speakers. So there's, to give you a description, because this is an audio podcast and you can't see AJ's picture unless you click through the link. There's this, the wall of the room is a brick fireplace.
Yeah.
Surrounded by, with bookshelves to the left and right that are surrounded by brick arches with a brick sort of seating area in front of the fireplace and the brick arches and bricks that go up to, I'm guessing, 10 feet up on the wall. And it's
right. With some space above that and creates a ledge where the cube speakers are sitting on top of that ledge, well above what you're looking at
on
the screen.
I'm guessing a good 3.5-4 feet above.
It's challenging. I would be tempted to put a center channel either immediately above or below that TV.
I mean, if you want to, the number one thing you could do immediately to make that sound better is take that center channel and figure out a way to drop it below the screen. And also, go easy on burning the fires underneath your HDTV.
You can always get another TV. The thing is, at least in this scenario, is it is wired at the front, so depending on the quality of that wiring, it shouldn't even matter. It should be fine for what we're, right. we're thinking of doing. But you could simply just swap those speakers out for something a little yeah. larger and a little more impressive as far as performance goes.
You know, it's a tough room because looking at the left speaker, the ceiling goes from probably about 20 feet high on the right side down to about, you know, 8 or 10 feet high on the left
ideally,
side.
Since you can't put these in wall within the brick, what you could do, only you could.
Well, there's also there's a spousal acceptance yeah. factor on in-wall speakers.
And you don't want to be, you may not want to actually move these speakers down to more appropriate heights by simply mounting brackets on that brick facade.
Well, here's the thing is you don't have to put them in the brick, right? Because there's those wooden bookshelves to the left and right the home theater. So my first thought would be to pull them down and put the left and right channels, get a small, subtle left and right channel. I mean, obviously, I would rather you had big, honking, floor-standing speakers.
Like debut 2.0.
6 feet up from the wall. But, you could put
they
the
look
debut
like
2.0
perfectly sized.
Been in there.
For that area.
There are a lot of, and let me just say right now, there are a ton of options here, AJ. And I teased you on Twitter because I am that way. You know, ideally, right, big floor standing speakers and just, you know, deal with the marital fallout, right? Gallo Acoustics makes some excellent, I want to say like 6-inch round speakers. They are premium and expensive, but, you know, their performance is pretty legendary. And they're artistic enough, they're stylish enough that there's this round thing sitting there.
Oh, yeah.
People won't really realize it's a speaker. Considerably less money. The crew down in LA, Orb Audio does some excellent stuff.
Oh, beautiful stuff.
That's orbaudio.com. Shoe Research has some small, very, very small bookshelf speakers that are well regarded, that are small enough that they would kind of fit or look like bookends on those bookshelves. They also have the amazing CCB-8 bookshelf speaker, but that's going to be probably bigger than you want to fit in that space.
Getting the wiring, though, to these side cabinets is something I would have to know more about what's in the walls and how things were done. Maybe there is a wire already going.
Right.
There is a obvious path to put the wire. Because you don't want to make it look terrible.
At the very least, if you could get that center channel
on top of the brick
down 4 or 5 feet so it was positioned, you know, horizontally and just underneath that monitor, that would make a huge difference.
I wish there was something like a soundbar almost sized center channel that you could use, because then they make some wonderful mount brackets. Yeah. This is a wall-mounted TV, and they make wonderful brackets,
well,
universal
it's funny,
brackets, too.
You should mention that, because like you're not going to be able to do Atmos at any time, as far as I know, but there's the Sonos 5.1 surround package. If you mounted that surround sound bar underneath the television and then put the play ones at the left and right, cue email asking me how I feel about the whole data capturing thing from Sonos, which doesn't really bother me that much because I don't care if they know what I'm listening to on Spotify, but although it irritates me that they capture it at all. What I'm saying is there's a ton of options.
I think so. I think he's got some great options there. And
of course, there's the debuts and, you know, the unifies would not work well in those bookshelves. The debuts would probably function. The debut 2.0s would function okay in those bookshelves if you can get permission to stuff it in there. But the center channel's going to look like a big thing.
Yeah.
Above the fireplace and below the speaker. And I'm thinking that's going to look horrible.
The nice thing about those universal mount brackets, at least for soundbars, you can mount them on the top or the bottom edge of the TV. And in this case, since it's right above a fireplace, I'd probably consider mounting that to the top of it if you were going that route. But this is also where I would like a set of debut 2.0s in white. Just to better match the decor, but it's still.
It's
there
nice, is,
there are some advantages there. And yeah.
Hopefully some of those are all speakers that are well reviewed and people love. So give them a shot.
Got some good options.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, there's some really good options on that list. We got another tweet from Fugar, aka at John K. No, at Fugar, aka John K. Reading is fundamental. At Robert Heron, have they fixed the issues with 4K play on the Xbox One yet?
I will default to Mr. John Archer over at Forbes, and he has been keeping track of the latest versions of software updates for the Xbox platform in terms of fixing the obvious error with elevated black levels in previous UHD playback on that game console. That part was fixed. They were also getting into a more esoteric or more definitely a more geeky error in terms of component video to RGB conversions that were being done by the player unnecessarily. And that was apparently causing some minor banding issues and other things. That was way less obvious compared to the elevated black levels. That part of it has been fixed, at least. And I'd be curious to see if they've done anything since in terms of getting the color conversions addressed as well. It should be something where you don't even have to think about it. It should just be fine. It is definitely better than it was. Is it on the same exact level of something like a Oppo Digital 203 or a 205? Probably, hopefully, it's getting closer. Mm-hmm. But it's a tough call. I like using game consoles for disc playback period.
Right.
My experience with Sony's PlayStation 3 is that was arguably one of the very best Blu-ray players ever made. And it's a shame that they never incorporated UHD disc playback into the PlayStation 4, because Sony was just...
That's such an odd decision.
It really, really kind of pissed me off. And but that Microsoft dropped the ball so hard in terms of their own disc playback on their game console, considering that they've been involved in these disc formats going well back before even DVD, in terms of creating the standards and test tools and things like that to do verification of the output of these players. It just seems odd that they, of all people, would have stumbled on it. But yes, it's pretty damn good now, and I'll be curious to see if they've finally massaged out that last little odd color conversion error that was still sneaking around back there. But otherwise, yeah, that's currently the only game console, thank you Microsoft, that is doing ultra high def disc playback.
Did you know discs are dead?
I know. Apparently so. Everyone's streaming. that 15.26 megabit Netflix stream, which, you know, it looks really good, but it ain't the same as a
no
UHD Blu-ray.
No, it's not.
Uh-uh.
Oh, my goodness. Do you care if a UHD Blu-ray movie was sourced from 2K?
Sure. That's referring to that.
That's at Paul.
Oh, yeah.
McElligot, by the way. When buying 4K Blu-rays, do you care if the movie was only finished as a 2K DI?
I would be bummed if that was the only source. Mm-hmm. I don't see that much on newer titles. Right. I have seen titles that incorporated lots of special effects and things like that, that the CG parts of the movie were processed and edited and incorporated as a 2K source,
right,
or as a 2K file.
Yeah, and well, the 2K DI is a 2K digital intermediate, and it's kind of weird. There's a lot of movies that are being distributed or sold as, you know, 4K or whatever that, you know, were essentially mastered in 2K, which is just, you know, another way of saying 1080p.
Yeah. See, that's the tough part. I want the improved resolution. I want the wider color palette. Mm-hmm. The fact that some of the material within a particular title might not be sourced from a 4K or greater original, that to me means a little less, but at the same point, I now suddenly want to look at a nice chart that right. says right up front, it's like, you know what, start to finish, we were recording everything, every aspect of this went through a 4K workflow. At no point was it ever dumped down and then brought back up for final distribution. So... do I care? Yeah, I guess I do. A little bit. Yeah. But I mean, when I look at like Christopher Nolan's films and things like that.
Right.
It's like, wow, okay, everything that guy's there are so many beautiful examples of his work in 4K.
Right.
That you can buy today. And in addition to probably some classic titles too, anything that's been properly either archived as 4K or greater
right.
is going to look terrific.
I think, I mean, it would be odd. It's funny because there's giant thread on this in the AVS forums I was reading. And
that's
one of the things is like, oh, they do it in 2K because, you know, they don't have 4K cameras or it's too expensive to store 4K or, you know, the computer graphics
the
people
CGI
don't want to work
in
4K. And, you know, this is one of those things where there's that sort of, again, the phrase of the show is transitional period.
My question is, 3.0, but I just received Blade Runner 2049 mm-hmm. in UHD Blu-ray. And now I'm wondering... I assume that was all 4K. I assume that every bit of that was at least workflowed and recorded and right. stored in a 4K or greater format. So But now I'm...
Well, here we go. We can go to realorfake4k.com.
Oh, excellent.
Shot in 3.4K, visual effects rendered in 3.4K. realorfake4k.com. So, although it does have a 4K master, the media was shot in less than 4K using a high-quality camera. Even films shot with 3.4K camera have more than three times the pixels as a 1080p Blu-ray. These titles should see a noticeable improvement over a standard Blu-ray. So it was shot in 3.4K. The visual effects are rendered in 3.4K. The digital intermediate is at 4K. So, because the thing, if you have a 2K digital intermediate, what you're looking at is them having to, what I will affectionately call, extrapolate, interpolate, or guess what those extra pixels are supposed to be.
It's encoded on the disc as 4K, but it's just, yeah, it is being upsampled, though, for that encode. Yeah. And here we go, 2049.
Oh, this is fun. So here we go. So Star Wars The Last Jedi is...
shot in 3.4K.
Mm-hmm.
The visual effects were rendered in 3.4K, and then that was transferred to a digital intermediate at 4K.
Yeah.
So...
I mean, 3.4K is most of 4K. And part of what's crazy is, like, if you look at The Last Jedi, it was shot on 35mm, 3.4K, 6.5K, and some scenes were shot in IMAX. The visual effects were rendered at around 3K, and the digital intermediate was done at 4K.
I guess you could say we are in a transitional period in terms of everyone's workflows and tools. It is not just unlimited in terms of resolution.
And all the 35 and 70 millimeter film negative was scanned in 4K.
That
so it
be
seems
an issue.
Like visual effects are still a big problem for a lot of people. Oh, this should be cruel.
I mean, for film, I mean, one of the better film scanners out there is the Photochem's Bigfoot scanner. And that was... That's been used to pull 8K scans of film stock or the sources of that. So
see, the real cruel one, you'll like this one. The Matrix is coming out in 4K UHD in May.
See, I doubt
so that was shot on 35mm.
Oh, okay.
They did a new scan for the digital intermediate 4K, and apparently it looks like they're going to re-render the visual effects.
Wow. At not every 2K. This is like a James Bond effect. They're not going to do this for every movie, but for certain titles, I think if they're popular enough, they might actually go back and find the original content and run it through a new workflow to make sure it's as good as can be. So
it'll be interesting to see, because apparently the visual effects on that will be rendered.
Actually, I like
2K.
This real or 4K, real or fake 4K website, because now I'm suddenly going through every disc I've recently purchased. Let's see. What was the other one I got? Interstellar.
Something I was thinking about, I don't know what I was watching last night, but it got me thinking that one of the big challenges is looking at movies that... Oh, goodness. It was the movie about the little furry-footed creatures that you hate so much.
Oh, yeah.
The Lord of the Rings trilogy.
Oh, yeah, that.
And watching the Lord of the Rings trilogy in 1080p, I'm really curious if they're going to re-render this. The CGI that looked so good on DVD does not look so realistic at 1080p, and I'm curious what they're going to do about 4K on that one.
I bag on that. Hey, Interstellar, shot on 35mm, some scenes on 70mm. The VFX, the visual effects, rendered in 4K and 5.6K.
Yeah.
Digital intermediate at 4K.
Yeah.
Glad I have that disc now.
I would be curious to find somebody, if anybody's listening that works in visual effects down in Hollywood and wants to teach us, learn us up about 2K rendering of visual effects in, you know, for 4K Ultra HD Blu-rays. Please email ask@avxl.com, because it's interesting, because we're looking at Saving Private Ryan, right? Shot on 35mm. It was rescanned at 4K. I want to buy that and bring it over here and watch it on your freaking television.
Let's do it.
And I think that's the other thing to think about is there's going to be a difference between watching, you know, 4K on a 60-inch screen that's 12 feet away from you and whether or not you pick this up versus like me staring at the Lord of the Rings at a 110-inch screen going like, oh.
God. Probably.
Frodo's looking a little funny running across that bridge.
I generally look at a 65-inch 4K TV from about 6 feet away.
Yeah.
That's about the distance I'm usually sitting. It's pretty close, relatively. So, I'm not... I want to see those pixels. And I will say, as much as we say that Blu-ray is the best compared to all streaming, the issues we see in streaming, especially in darker scenes with compression artifacts and things like that,
Blu-ray releases are great. However, there are some key examples, though, of where either the encoding or processing, there can be artifacts that were encoded into that video as well in certain titles. And that includes 4K Ultra High Def. It's as good as the work put into it. That is something, though, to be aware of if you are doing any kind of reviewing or analysis of these displays with content, is to be familiar as you can with what the errors are within the content you're looking at.
And that's a good thing. There's like a ton of forums that talk about that stuff. And
it's like, oh, there's some banding in this one scene, and it's actually, that's in the encode.
Blu-ray reviews can help you with that. Because there's been some cases, especially some early Blu-rays, Patton was one of the ones that really struck me, where somebody just went nuts. And they didn't exactly make everybody look like a cartoon character, but they didn't exactly make everybody look real. I think somebody was literally like, you know, I just don't like film grain, and decided to sort of...
Let's smooth it out. Let's take some detail.
One last question before we go, and then I got a bomb up on the highway. Sirpy writes, hey, you talked about a lot of products but didn't mention, and could be the category wasn't represented at CanJam, headphones that are designed for sleeping. Have you used any of these? They could probably be used during traveling as well. And he's got a link to a website called Headphones Lab, which shouldn't be as hard to pronounce as it is. Headphoneslab.com. And they're listed the best headphones for sleeping. And it's funny that you should mention that, because one of the preeminent designers of San Diego manufactured planar magnetic headphones. You can figure out who that is if you're a headphone geek.
Mr. Speakers.
One of his family members attends the shows and works the shows, and was pointing out that he often falls asleep in a set of his, you know, excellent planar magnetic headphones. And that made me feel better, because I usually don't tell people. I fall asleep in my good headphones.
Okay.
I don't, you know, not every night, but, you know, I've certainly fallen asleep in like the Sony, you know, MDR-06s, Odyssey Sign. Like I don't use the really giant ones that stick out from my head. And the hi-fi planar magnetics, I will not fall asleep in, because
they roll around too much.
They will disintegrate. Yeah.
What I have done, though, is simply use the earbuds. For whatever reason, it depends on the earbud design. If it goes the in-ear earphones or not, if they actually are flush to the side of my head and I can actually comfortably lay on the side of my head, I find that some of the, you know, the damn earbuds that come with my cell phone have like a perfect fit in terms of being able to be flush to the side of my head, where it really doesn't matter. I've never even thought about leaving headphones on, because I just assume when I wake up they're going to be like askewed on my face, or I've like I don't know. I could see falling asleep to it, but at some point I'm going to wake up and those things are wrapped around me. I'm fighting with a cord or something.
I'm a little nervous that I'm going to choke myself to sleep.
I've used a lot of earplugs, just like foam earplugs to put in for just killing noise when I sleep. But
I would say, I mean, my issue is that a lot of, you know, a lot of the, you know, we've generated these headphones to maximize your fun sleeping experience. It's just a lot of these... a lot of these that I've seen are kind of poorly built. And like I said, I just use my regular headphones.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you take a look at something, for example, the Cozy Phones, which are kind of like a headphone in sort of a headbandy kind of thing. Sleep Phones has got a similar construction. You know, if you're looking at a product that's got, you know, 1,000-something 4.5-star reviews on Amazon, that's a good sign that, you know, people like these.
Yeah.
You know, and Sleep Phones example, for example, there's like a wireless version. So if you do want something that, you know, is not going to choke you to death and is not going, you know, to require, it's going to actually stay on your head, you know, yeah, go check them out. But these are not engineered for the maximum audio awesomeness. These are engineered to help you pass out and not fall off your head as you roll around.
I mean, my go-to, and I do this practically every night I go to sleep, when I'm not worried about disturbing someone with a little noise, I will take my cell phone and load up some podcasts and turn the volume down really low, but no earphones at all, no headphones, just have that laying next to me. And suddenly I'm snoozing very comfortably. So, but that's just one option I have too. I never think about actually wearing earphones or headphones as I'm sleeping, at least not as a rule. I see that many people do. And I've even seen those crazy things like you can get a speaker that goes under your pillow.
Yeah.
And then as you lay there, you'll be able to hear that, but then you'd be less likely to disturb anyone around you who's trying to get a quiet night of sleep, or who needs the silence. I, as a person who have once fell asleep in the back of a car that had like an 18-inch subwoofer rolling, and I had no problem sleeping back there. And it's like, I can sleep through a lot.
I've fallen asleep before takeoff in Las Vegas and slept until planes hit the ground. And
planes are the ultimate place for me to nap. I'm just like, oh my goodness, snooze fest, man.
But, you know, Sirpy, I haven't used any of these because I just use my regular headphones. Most of these are designed more for staying on your head than musical awesomeness. And, you know, a couple of them are really, really highly reviewed on Amazon. I would stick to those. So go check them out.
Good deal.
AVXL.com is the website where you can find the links to subscribe or just search on iTunes or the Google Play Store, wherever you like to get your podcasts. If you want to support the show, please go to patreon.com/AVXL. Tweet at Robert Herron or at Patrick Norton or at AVXL with your questions. Or you can email us, like we said, at ask@AVXL. We want to thank each and every one of you for listening to the podcast. And keep sending your questions because they drive the show and let us know what we should be covering. Thank you so much. I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Robert Herron.
We'll catch you next week on AVXL.